Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Mothers of Invention. This is special for two reasons. First of all, it's the last episode of our first series.
And it's special because we're broadcasting direct from Climate Week in New York.
Yeah, so in case you can't tell our voices apart by now, I am Maeve Higgins and we're here in my adopted hometown, New York, like Mary said. So what I do here is I make fun podcasts about serious things and otherwise I just try and keep out of trouble.
And you're not so good at that, but and I'm Mary Robinson,
yeah.
And I'm former Irish head of state, and I think I know quite a bit now about climate justice.
I think so.
And you can think of me as Batman to Maeve's Robin.
Yes, and that Kevlar batsuit that you're wearing, it really suits you.
No, not necessary, but...
I mean, they can't see because it's audio, but I just want them to know. In this series, Mothers of Invention, we explore ways in which climate change, despite being a man-made problem,
has a multitude of feminist solutions. And I think, you know, for the sake of those who aren't quite with it, feminist solutions absolutely includes men. That's the message. And in every episode, we introduce our listeners to very inspirational mothers of invention who are leading the charge with solutions to climate change all over the world. And we hear their genuinely incredible stories.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, so impressive.
We've had some amazing guests on, and I think that we recorded all of our other shows on location where our mothers live and work, and also in the studios that we used in Dublin and Dublin where you live. And we also went to London. But today you're in New York to record this podcast because it's just more convenient for me.
And it's also a very big week in New York. It's actually nothing to do with the fact that you're here, Maeve. It's a big week. It's climate week.
It's climate
so
week.
So I'm actually
thanks for,
in town
thanks for
myself,
not letting me you know, even have that,
with a
Mary.
Very busy week of lots of people. And
yeah.
You're not coming into the UN with me, and don't ask. This is the 10th climate week. Every September,
yes.
In a coordination with the United Nations, government and business leaders from across the world, mm-hmm. gather in New York to further their responsibilities towards climate change. It's all about how they'll reach the Paris Agreement goals and keep catastrophic climate change at bay. And we're not on course enough. So this week is important.
Yeah, there's a sense of urgency. Everybody convenes here and then you sort of hang out, you spend time together, you figure out what the priorities are, what's working. And then I suppose like any group of people, you maybe get some drinks together, blow off some steam, go clubbing.
Maeve, it's a bit more serious than that. it's panels, it's discussions,
right.
It's seminars, it's diplomacy, it's all of that. It's getting up early in the morning. It's going to be quite busy.
So no dancing?
Well, not ruling that out.
Well, I'm really delighted because it's such rich pickings for us here. There's all these businesses and governments and academic institutions and NGOs working towards the Paris Agreement. And we're going to try and nab a few of them while they're in town to come and chat with us here in the studio, but only if they qualify as a mother of invention.
Absolutely. And this episode, we'll be joined by the architect of the Paris Agreement herself, mm-hmm. Cristiana Figueres from Costa Rica, a very good friend, who'll give us her diplomat's bird's eye view on our global progress and where we need to apply more pressure as citizens. She's really very articulate, very good at this.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to meet her. We're also going to meet President Hayne of the Marshall Islands.
Heine.
Oh, Heine?
Mm-hmm. Really? President Heine.
Oh, you're so happy that I got that wrong.
There's room for improvement.
And we're going to meet President Heine, the first female leader of the Marshall Islands, a nation facing the very real and imminent threat of climate change. But first, we meet a South African activist working in both human rights and climate for many years, previously head of Greenpeace and the new Director General of Amnesty International. Please welcome our mother of invention, Kumi Naidoo. Welcome.
Here he is.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Sounds like you're having fun.
Yes.
The best activism is activism with fun.
Oh, you think so?
Absolutely.
Can you like...
Now, Maeve, I start with Kumi because he's my friend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I start with him. Okay, Kumi, welcome.
Thank you,
welcome
Maeve.
To
Thank
Mothers
you.
of Invention.
To be with both
it's
of you.
It's great, really, to have you here. And you and I obviously know each other for...
Very long.
A very long time.
Do you remember the first time you met?
Yes.
Tell us.
It was at the World Conference Against...
Racism
and xenophobia
in Durban, South Africa, your country.
And I had been helping with the processes leading up to it.
And I had the very difficult job of being the Secretary General of the conference.
Wow.
And having so much pressure. And I needed friends on the ground.
Yeah. Wow. Mm. And that
it was tough.
I can imagine.
But interestingly, the climate issue was there.
I mean, you've had quite a history of activism as a young man, indeed as a young boy. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, I got involved in 1980 mm-hmm. in the National Student Uprising, and our focus was on the inequality in education. In fact, the slogan at the front of the march was, "We want equality."
What age were you?
15.
Oh.
And by the time the slogan got to the back of the march, the younger kids were chanting, "We want a colour TV," because because kids in white schools had colour TVs and kids in black schools had no TVs. And to be honest, at that time, I wanted equality and a colour TV almost equally. and you were like,
where my passion lies in TV, but I guess I'll go for equality.
So what happened was, because the state used so much of repression and so on, and eventually I got expelled from school. And that, as governments often miscalculate when they think they use repression, they think it's an act of strength on their part, but actually it's usually an admission of weakness on their part. Mm-hmm. And
so tell us about mobilizing against the apartheid regime.
Well, mobilizing against the apartheid regime was tough because it was, firstly, we have the same problem we have, for example, in the United States, where the media environment is gone AY, you know, where 40% of the people are watching Fox and getting a completely false view of reality. Yeah. So we had something called the South African Broadcasting Corporation, SABC, which we call the South African Brainwashing Corporation.
Wow.
So we had the media heavily stacked against us, and we were perpetually followed by the police, surveilled and so on. But when you are standing up for something that is so patently just and right, however much repression you use, you cannot defeat it. For me personally, it was a tough time.
You were arrested.
I was arrested many times. And
and then you went to England.
Yeah, well, and that's by some mistake.
And that's why you speak English so well.
Like actually, us, Mary. Thank God for the English.
Actually, the Rhodes Scholarship Committee made a mistake and gave me a Rhodes Scholarship, and I landed up in Oxford University. I should say that, you know, as a young person, when I got involved, it was a tough time for me because my mum committed suicide literally weeks before the National Student Uprising started. And when I was invited to be on the Mother of Invention series, I was a bit hesitant. And then I remembered that when I was 19 and 20, I was a live-in house father at a children's home responsible for 12 boys.
And you were?
Most of the biggest wisdoms I learned was from my mother, even though she left us so early.
Mm.
For example, she said, "It is much better to be honest and unpopular than dishonest and popular."
Yeah.
She said, "You should always, it is much better to try and fail than to fail to try."
Mm.
And on religion, I remember one teacher was trying to convert people from one religion to the other. And I went home and I said, "Mom, my favorite teacher is trying to do this." And she said to me, "You know, all religions are the same. And the most important thing is you should see God in the eyes of every human being that you meet." And that's been my sort of spiritual philosophy since then, which has worked for me.
Oh, wow. Well, we're thrilled to have you. Actually, you're the first male Mother of Invention that we've had. So we're delighted.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about, because, you know, you've got to justify yourself now as a Mother of Invention. You've done a lot.
I mean, he climbed an oil rig. That's pretty good.
No. But he's also done a lot on violence against women and other things. Talk a bit about.
So sadly, South Africa has one of the highest levels of violence against women and children. It is rooted in our history of gender inequality and an absence of protection, particularly of black women, but all women in South Africa. So in 1997, I was honored to be part of a broad coalition where I was the convener, called the National Men's March Against Violence on Women and Children. And that led to the adoption of the first Domestic Violence Act.
Wow.
Madiba marched with us.
And you moved to climate as head of Greenpeace. Tell us about that.
Well, The funny thing was, all the media in my first month in the job were asking me, oh, so you've left human rights, anti-poverty and gender equality activism to go to the environment side. And my response was the struggle to avert catastrophic climate change and the struggle to ensure human rights, anti-poverty and so on must, can and should be seen as two sides of the same coin.
And because we're speaking to you now and you've just been the head of Amnesty International for a month now.
5 weeks. And the funny thing is
I would now, let him talk about climate first now before he...
No, the funny thing about it is 5 weeks now, because I'd been 6 years at Greenpeace, everybody's asking me, so you've left environment to go to human rights. I said, actually, all of these things are intersecting. Yeah. And I think one of the things the women's movement offered to us many decades ago and the feminist theory did was a very powerful idea, but a terrible word, intersectionality. Right? Yeah. I think one of the mistakes that humanity has made over time is to take the different challenges and problems we have and put them in silos. Yeah. You know, there's something called human rights, something called gender equality, anti-poverty, and so on. Mm-hmm. In reality, most ordinary people don't live their lives like that. They are facing multiple different challenges and they have to respond to multiple challenges. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I would argue one of the biggest problems with climate activism as it has emerged is that we have framed it for far too long as primarily or solely in some cases as an environmental issue. Mm-hmm. Climate change is it's an issue of the economy, it's the issue of peace and justice, and I would say it's the issue of gender, because if we look at one of the things that is clearly happening is that where we are seeing climate impacts, we're seeing the rise of conflict and war and so on. Mm. And we know that in violent contexts, women and children pay the biggest price. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at it from that angle and many other feminist angles, you can see that we have to see climate change as quintessentially also a feminist and an issue of gender inequality.
And, you know, you've walked the talk, you've climbed the talk when you were with Greenpeace. If I'm not mistaken, you climbed an oil rig in the Arctic and you can't swim.
Really?
Tell us about that.
Well, the funny thing was, when I was in prison in Greenland, after we climbed the rig, we climbed the rig to deliver 50,000, a petition with 50,000 names to the captain of the rig to say, please stop.
Good,
And then we got arrested, me and another colleague, and we ended up in prison in Greenland. And my brother went to national television in South Africa to mobilize for my release. And they asked him, so what exactly was he doing in the Arctic? And my brother says, you know, to be honest, I really don't know. But I can tell you he must be really committed because he can't swim to save his backside. So,
it was freezing.
And then for African, it was extremely freezing, I can tell you that. And then the next year, we went to Russia, to the Russian Arctic. And when I was there, the lowest minimum sea ice level was reached.
Yeah.
And humanity ignores how close we are to the precipice of disaster. And sadly, the people that are paying the first and most brutal price for climate impacts are the people actually who have been least responsible for actually creating it.
Kumi, you know, we've talked quite a lot in the past about a kind of mass movement to tackle climate change. And you're now head of Amnesty. How many members does Amnesty have?
We have 7 million, and our ambition is to be close to 20 million in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. And we have a plan to actually make Amnesty bigger, bolder, and more inclusive. And we are opening our arms as wide as possible to invite people to get actively involved. And, you know, Amnesty is one home where people can actually come and get involved.
Yeah.
But I generally say, you know, there are many ways, whether you join Amnesty or whether you join a local group, it's fine. Mm.
Yeah.
But get involved. Because when our children, in a decade or so from now, look us in the eye and say, when the science said our future was at risk, what did you do to make a difference? Mm. And people have to realize this is not about saving the planet.
Mm.
Actually, if we continue on the path that we are, the end result would be we deplete our water sources, we destroy our soil, we cannot produce food,
And we have more and more people coming on board who need water, food, a world that's livable.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the end result will be, we'll be gone as a species. The planet will still be here.
Right.
And quite honestly, once we become extinct as a species, the forests will recover, the oceans will replenish and so on. So let's understand that the struggle to avert catastrophic climate change is fundamentally a struggle to protect our children and their children's futures. And there can be nothing more important than that.
That's an incredibly important message. It's about people and their lives and the closing of space for civil society and the real compelling issues about land rights and water rights and community voice and indigenous rights. It's all connected. So I'm very glad you've taken on this role in Amnesty. More power to you, Kumi.
Thank you very much.
I think we're closing off now, but thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much, Mary. Thank you very much, Mary.
Thank you, Kumi. I feel like you're going to sneak away now and do something really cool and civilly disobedient.
Not tonight, but soon.
Thank you, Kumi.
No, thank you very much, Kumi.
Mary, it's actually a few days after we talked to Kumi. We're midweek and a lot has already happened. I did a comedy show the night...
Now stop posting.
I didn't say it went well, but I certainly got up there and I performed. I don't know, what have you been doing? I mean, it's a huge week for you, Climate Week here in New York.
It's a very important week, and Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, has already made an unprecedented call to action. As he made clear, there is now a full-blown climate crisis. It's not something of the future, and it requires an urgent response. And this week, governments and businesses, I must say, have been responding to that call.
So you've been having meetings, panels, you've been, you know, chairing discussions.
Yeah, it began with a peace summit in honour of Nelson Mandela, with lots of heads of state there, and almost all of them mentioned climate in their speech because it's so important and so urgent. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I attended a meeting in the General Assembly on the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Right. And I spoke about the link between human rights and climate change. And then I was delighted that Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who has brought her baby into the One Planet Summit, or at least her husband held the baby while she gave her speech. She spoke very, very well.
I don't think they're married. I think they're partners.
You're right.
Yeah.
Her partner. She spoke so well. And she announced that New Zealand is providing $300 million over the next 4 years for the Pacific Islands, for her neighbourhood, as she calls it. And that will mean an awful lot to, for example, the Marshall Islands. We'll be talking to President Heine later.
Kumi, we heard from him earlier in the show. And how has it been going? Did you hear his speech at the Mandela Peace Summit?
Yes, it was a very good speech. He didn't pull his punches. Mm-hmm. Lots of people want to go in and, you know, say something in front of heads of state and then they get shy or they get nervous. He didn't. I loved the way that Kumi spoke about not adjusting to the human rights abuses against the Rohingya, against the Palestinians, against the Syrians. Yeah. And he also said, and I'd like to just quote this passage, he said, "We should not adjust to continuing inaction on averting catastrophic climate change. To the one leader who still denies climate change, we insist you start putting yourself on the right side of history."
And what's exciting is the two more of the rock stars of this week. They're going to be joining us in studio this morning. I'm really excited to meet them, but you already know them both quite well. Could you tell me about Christiana Figueres, Mary?
Yes, Christiana is a great woman and a great communicator about climate change. After the Copenhagen summit more or less failed to deliver, Christiana was in charge of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. She started in 2010 and then had to work towards the Paris Agreement in December 2015. And she really did the most impactful work because she kept being optimistic and hopeful. And when you think about the diplomatic and strategic process that got us to that euphoric, triumphant moment when we finally reached an agreement, you just know that she's really a worthy Mothers of Invention.
Oh, I can't wait to meet her. So we're waiting on her and our other guest, who is the president of the Marshall Islands. You and she have something in common because you were both the first women presidents of island nations, and you're both leaders on climate justice, and both of your husbands have beards. They're like hipsters.
Well, yes, President Heine is in my club, if you like, and she's a wonderful advocate for her people who really are on the front lines of climate change. Mm-hmm. The Marshall Islands consists of small atolls and are in huge danger from rising sea levels. Hilda, because she's my friend. We had breakfast together yesterday.
But I'll call her Madam President.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
But she began her career as a high school teacher and then a women's organiser before she became Minister of Education. And now, as President, she's calling us all out on our responsibility to our brothers and sisters in the Pacific Islands.
So those are two more guests that we're getting to grab during Climate Week.
President Heine and Christiana Figueres are both very, very busy women this week, as I know. So it's wonderful that they're taking time to squeeze us in.
Yeah, I promise I won't embarrass you in front of your cool friends. I think I can see them arriving through the glass now.
Wow.
Yeah, there's two... Yeah, there's a big group of people there here with
and
their
posses. They're coming
posses.
Together. That's
great. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Hi.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam President.
Hi.
Good morning.
How are
you? I think if you sit beside Maeve over there, and Christiana.
Hi.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm Maeve.
Great to see you.
Nice to meet you.
And if you sit here beside me.
This is an early morning for
us.
So thank you so much for coming in. Yeah. I know you have a huge week.
Actually, if we weren't busy while we were here, that would be real trouble.
Wouldn't that
right?
be bad if you just came to New York to go shopping?
Yeah. That would be a real problem. So it's delightful to be busy.
Well, welcome to both of you, two mothers of invention. And,
thank you.
And Madam President, you made a very ambitious and admirable commitment announced on Monday. Just tell us a bit about that on behalf of your country, the Marshall Islands.
Yeah, well, one of the important commitments, I suppose, under the Paris Agreement is for countries to develop their 2050 strategies.
Yes.
And so the Marshall Islands announced or launched its 2050 strategy on Monday, and we're the first island nation to be able to do that. And also, I think the number 10 in countries around the world to be able to pull that together. So we're very encouraged and... of course, the easy part was pulling together that strategy. The hard part is getting the finance to be able to make that happen.
Yeah.
You know, so this is one of the challenges for us and something that we're hoping to engage partners and get the support for it.
Do you know how much money?
Tens of millions of dollars, or maybe hundreds of millions is a lot of money. So.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money that we certainly don't have, and so that's why it's such a challenge. But I think the message there also is that if a small country can pull this together, you know, everybody else can do it. And the encouragement, or we want to encourage other countries to develop their own strategy, because when we all do that, you know, we have a better chance of meeting the 1.5 degrees.
So, Christiana, we started this podcast series explaining the Paris Agreement and why it's so important that we achieve what we set out in that agreement. Are we on course to fulfill it?
You know, there is a fantastic word in German that doesn't exist in other languages, which is Jein, which is both yes and no at the same time. If I could create a word in every single language, I would create that word.
Yeah.
But that's my answer to you, okay? Yes, we are on track in the sense that we are irreversibly decarbonizing some sectors. Definitely the energy sector, or rather the electricity sector.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely the transportation sector. Increasingly looking at better and better numbers on finance and shifting of capital. But that is about the end of the list. We do not have the same progress on land use. We do not have the same progress on heavy industry. And even though those sectors that are in the lead are moving in the right direction, they're not moving at the right speed. So we have some proof that, yes, we are definitely doing the right thing, but are we doing it at the scale and the speed that we need? No. So that's why it's both yes and no.
Yeah,
and so before I met Mary and before we started to make this show, I wasn't 100% clear on what the Paris Agreement was.
And
but
are
the
you
thing,
now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh my God, I've spent a lot of time with Mary. Please.
I'm going to quiz you now.
I can, even when I'm drunk, I can recite what the Paris Agreement. But I mean, the thing is, the big thing that I understood was that it was this promise by over 190 countries to keep global warming well below the 2 degrees Celsius, to pursue efforts to limit the temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. So is it too
early
to speak?
Isn't she pretty good now? I mean, wouldn't you give her a pass at least?
Yeah, but the question is, can she really do that out of her memory, or does she have a little cheat sheet? That's the question.
And Madam President, you're not only the President of the Marshall Islands, you're also Chair of the Climate Vulnerable Forum of 48 countries, isn't it?
Yes, tell us a bit about something that I'm still learning about. You know, we assumed the chairmanship of that in August.
Okay.
So it hasn't been that long. And so
you have to learn 48 languages?
Well, I hope not.
Tell us about that. What you're doing to have a summit that's different.
That's what the first activity as a chairperson of this summit is organizing this virtual summit for where we're inviting all leaders and leaders of countries
I'm going to test you. Virtual summit. Why is that good for the environment?
No, hold on. What does it mean? What does it mean?
It means
for
you
us?
Kind of imagine a summit.
Imagine. Oh, it's a little bit more than that. Because this is the first time it's ever been done.
Yes.
Ever.
Really?
Ever.
Yes. Virtual summit.
This is absolutely groundbreaking.
Yeah, we're hoping that at least 60 countries, leaders, as well as leaders of organizations, subnational actors, and so on, would be able to participate in that 24-hour period.
Oh, wow.
Where everyone
because
will.
Because all the time zones that you're
that's
trying to
that's it, exactly. So it will be tricky, but we hope that it can be pulled off.
I mean, I feel like if you invited everyone to the Marshall Islands, they'd be thrilled, but
well, they can, but we
fly.
Don't have enough hotel rooms in the Marshall Islands to accommodate everyone, and the flights are only, you know, like three times a week, so we wouldn't be able to get everyone there.
And
the emission, of course, you know, this is the most important.
Can you tell us specifically how the Marshall Islands are, you know, planning to cope? Because I was reading before I met you, I was reading that like even 16 inches of sea level rise would mean that the island become unlivable.
Exactly.
As president, like, what does that, like, what, you know, what actions are you thinking, like, we have to do this right now? And what are you doing right now?
Well, I stay up at night and worry about it. We're only 2 meters above the sea level. Mm-hmm. And so when we're very serious about the 1.5, because otherwise we will be submerged. And there are some reports that have just come out that they say in 2030 that our islands might be go underwater. So we're very concerned because we're a country that we don't want to move out of our sovereign territory. We want to stay there. And so migration is not an option that we're thinking about. We definitely want to stay in our islands. Mm-hmm. So right now we're seriously looking at possibilities for adaptation, one of which would be to, you know, build up islands where, you know, we would have communities more than 2 meters above sea level so that we can maintain our presence in our own sovereign territory.
I just want to underscore 2 points that President Haine has just said that are really very critical. One is the commitment of the Marshall Islands to the 2050 strategy, which is exemplary, right? But the point is that the Marshall Islands, as it exists today, will not be able to live like that into the future unless everybody has a 250 strategy. Mm-hmm. It's not like the enormous effort that the Marshallese have done to figure out the strategy is actually going to guarantee that they can stay living on their island the way that they live now. It takes all of us to actually ensure livable conditions into the future. And the other really important point is that we tend to think that people migrate because they want to. Mm-hmm. That's not true.
Absolutely.
People, you know, would much prefer to stay at home in their own culture with their ancestors that are buried and with their culture, with their families, with their traditions, with their languages. This is about forced migration, right? It's not voluntary migration. It's a completely different issue. And forced migration will occur unless all of us collaborate together to get ourselves toward actually 2 things. Yes, 2050, but also to get ourselves to the point where we can bend the curve of emissions by 2020. So, you know, the president is speaking to very, very, very deep issues that need the collaboration of everyone. What the Marshall Islands is doing is being a role model, but they cannot take the full responsibility.
Yesterday, Christiana, you gave a brilliant speech to the finance and investment sector. You tasked them with taking leadership and working ahead of the curve. Can you tell us why, in your view, finance and investment is such an important area?
Well, because nothing gets built unless it's financed, to put it very simply, right?
Yeah.
And the fact is that we will continue, because we still have at least 1 billion brothers and sisters who will be joining us on this planetary home.
I loved that there was a new baby, wasn't there? Didn't Prime Minister Prime Minister Ardern brought her little child into the UN?
Yeah, she's fantastic.
And in fact, I had asked Mary if she'd bring me, but she wouldn't.
Well, you probably don't fit into that little
I definitely
snuggly.
Don't.
Anyway, back to finance.
But back to finance. So we know that we're investing into infrastructure anyway, right? We're investing about 70 to 80 trillion dollars into infrastructure over the next 15 years because we need that to construct everything that is going to make it that is going to provide for the well-being of the population that we're expecting. So that's not the issue, is whether we're going to invest. The issue is, what is the carbon intensity and the resilience of that infrastructure? Because it has to be both. It has to be low carbon, it has to be resilient to the impacts that we already know we're going to have. And so that puts it up to $90 trillion. So if we invest $90 trillion over the next 15 years into infrastructure that is resilient and low carbon, then we have actually answered a huge part of climate change. Conversely, if we continue over the next 15 years to invest into infrastructure that is high carbon and non-resilient, we have actually cemented ourselves in, and I use the word very, very deliberately, cemented ourselves in, locked ourselves in.
Explain high carbon.
Well, all the fossil fuels, right? In particular, coal. In particular, you know, if we continue to invest into more, digging up more coal in more coal mines and coal plants, just to take the extreme, but, you know, it's a whole gamut there of fossil fuels. But just to, honestly, we can no longer afford one more coal mine, one more coal plant.
I just wanted to ask you, Madam President, I mean, Christiana has put the case of the importance of finance very well.
Yes.
You need a lot of money. Are you getting, can you get that investment?
Yeah, well, that's one of, as I said, that's a big challenge for us.
Yeah.
It's not easy to get to the funds. I know that.
But you have gone solar on some of the islands.
We have. Almost all of our outer islands are solarized. And so people live on home solar systems. And so we intend to continue that. But in our two most populated areas, they're powered by diesel generators. And so currently we're beginning to work with the World Bank to see if we can get financing to change the diesel into renewable energy. And we have some financing that is coming in, but it's still not nearly enough, and it's not fast enough coming in. And so that's ongoing. But at the same time, we're spending our own little monies on seawalls and other things around our graveyards and homes to protect, because there is more frequent king tides and inundations. And so we have to continue to spend whatever little resources we have on building up those and taking care of our people.
Now, I can see your people knocking on the window, and I think that probably Madam President, Christiana Figueres, do you have to go on to your what's next for you today?
Well, next for me is I'll be speaking at the...
You're going to do a panel?
Presidents
tend to give keynotes rather than panels.
Right.
And
then,
and how about you, Christiana?
So I have the honor of chairing this, you know, amazing group of heads of state who are going to be launching the Carbon Neutrality Coalition today, which is quite exciting. With our very fantastic president of Marshall Islands, New Zealand PM, and quite a few others. So it's a very exciting day.
Yeah, it sounds like the cool gang at Climate Week. That's great. Okay, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Bye.
Well, that brings us to the end of this Climate Week episode then, Mary.
Yes, Maeve. And it's not only the end of this episode. It's the end of the first series of Mothers of Invention.
So have you enjoyed it? I know that when we started, you didn't, you know, you didn't know what a podcast was.
Well, that was about a year ago.
Do you feel like you're down with the kids now? Have you been listening to any other podcasts?
I must say it's certainly been an experience and I've enjoyed it. And I must say I've really enjoyed getting to know you. And I now know you're more famous than I thought because I heard you on a program when I was in Palo Alto. On a comedy program.
Oh, but I was always telling you how famous I was.
Well, don't overdo it. And I think a lot of people tell me that they really listen to you. You know, they hear the program through your questions because they're in your position, if you know what I mean.
Because
Because
I'm learning on the show.
Yeah.
And I think, well, I'm really glad to hear that. That's when I get messages from people online and, or my friends and family and people I know who listen. They kind of say that too, because I think, not that I'm 100% ignorant, but I'm close.
You're good at asking questions, I'll give you that.
Okay, that's a really lovely way of putting it. But I've certainly learned so much doing this podcast.
And I must say, what I really like is, although you didn't know much about climate, as soon as we started talking about climate justice, you got it.
Yes.
The injustice of climate change, that you got immediately. And that was very important for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was the kind of switch that flipped in my brain, where I was like, oh, yeah, the people who are affected and the reality of, you know, it's not this abstract, you know, concept to me anymore. I think spending time with you and also learning from Anne Polina, you know, she was a guest who, you know, we just talked to her in the studio. She was just in our headphones, but I really was moved by Anne. And, you know, listeners can go back and listen if they haven't had a chance to hear her. She was a river protector and she spoke about healing. And I think that really gave me hope, where before I was quite sort of frozen. And I think, like a lot of people, I was paralyzed by, oh, this huge change, you know, all of this kind of nightmare that we're facing. But I think she had such hope and the actions that she took. And I've taken actions, as you know. I changed banks. I moved my money. I eat differently now. I have 3 houseplants. You know what else? Like, I'm really, after spending this time and listening to you and all the Mothers of Invention, I've got such a much higher sensor now, and I'm so allergic to this sort of like patriarchal nonsense telling me that I don't have power or that I don't have control over what I do, or that what I do doesn't make a difference. So that's been really helpful to me. And also, I think I'm a better listener now.
Well, that's an improvement.
And Mary, as well as this podcast, you've written a book that's actually coming out this week.
It's actually out here in the United States and comes out shortly in the rest of the world. It's called Climate Justice, Hope, Resilience and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. And there are 11 stories in the book. In fact, 9 of them are about women, but they're all stories of people trying to cope. There's the former president of Kiribati, who talks about going to Copenhagen and being in despair, that it looked as if his country was not going to have any future. That was before the Paris commitment to 1.5. Indigenous peoples, a bit like Anne that you talked about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've learned so much from those who are on the front lines of climate change. And that's why I talk about climate justice.
Yeah.
But it's really been good in this program that we've talked to such a variety of people in different contexts, all of them women up to now, but, you know, showing such resilience, such courage and such hope. That's one of the things that comes through.
So we're taking a break, but we'll be back next year with a second series. And in the meantime, I would ask our listeners, please tell your friends and neighbours. A really good way of passing podcasts around is literally taking someone's phone and showing them how to listen to podcasts. And you can also binge listen to the whole first series now. Mary, I don't know what we're going to do now when we're not recording. You never saw the film Changing Places, did you? Or Freaky Friday, you know, when people swap lives. Would you like to do that? You could be a comedian and I could go into the UN and give speeches and wear cool blazers.
Maeve, there is no way that I could let you loose in the UN. I mean, I've told you that. But a big thank you to all our amazing Mothers of Invention. that we've featured on this first season. We're so impressed and inspired by you all. We want people to go in and look at your lives and support you. Thank you for all you do and keep going. You are the movement the world needs.
And you can find out more about the series and all of the mothers that we met today and throughout the season and turn all this inspiration into action at mothersofinvention.online.
And follow us for updates and more episodes on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
And if you love the series and you want to support us, you can do it on Kickstarter's patronage platform Drip. Go to d.rip/mothersofinvention to contribute. And thanks to the community of supporters who have backed us through this first series.
Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society, and it's made possible by the Compton Foundation and the Wallace Global Fund.
This episode was produced by Hazel Falk with executive producers Jess Search and BD Finzi of Doc Society. Our New York editor and episode mixer was Anne Pope. Our series consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King, Catherine Wilkinson and Suzanne Dhaliwal. Our theme music is Water Fountain by Tune Yards with kind permission from 4AD and Marriage Records.